Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have another report on the historic American roadway, Route 66. You will hear how many Americans traveled west along the highway during the 1930s. This migration, or movement from one place to another, inspired American author John Steinbeck to write one of his most popular books. Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson have the story.
America's tallest monument dominates the skyline of St. Louis, Missouri, the largest city on Route 66 between Chicago and Los Angeles. The Gateway Arch represents the beginning of the American West. It also commemorates St. Louis's role in the nation's westward expansion. Early settlers in the 1800s depended on the city as a final chance to stock up on food and other provisions before making the long journey west. The Gateway Arch towers above St. Louis on the banks of the Mississippi River. The 192-meter-tall stainless steel arch is the tallest structure of its kind in the world. Finnish-American architect Eero Saarinen won a national competition for a design of the proposed monument in 1947. Construction of the Gateway Arch was completed in 1965.
Karen Stieber works at the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial, which includes the Gateway Arch.
The arch commemorates the 300,000 people who, after Jefferson made the Louisiana Purchase, moved from the eastern part of the country west. And this was kind of the meeting place for all of them. This was the last big city where they could provision up before they went west.
The Gateway Arch has an internal tram system. Visitors can ride to the top of the arch for a good view of St. Louis and the Mississippi.
And Eero Saarinen, the architect, made it in the shape of a gate, kind of like you open the gate and step into the new country.
That new country held promise, but it held tragedy too. The westward expansion of the 1800s brought many Americans to settle on the Great Plains of the United States. Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas offered good land for farming and raising cows in the early years of settlement.
Then, in the 1930s, disaster struck. A severe and long-lasting drought destroyed crops across the southern Great Plains. Over-farming, or planting too many crops, had destroyed the area's natural grasslands. This left the land unprotected from the windstorms that arrived with the drought. The result was several years of massive, deadly dust storms. The huge area of prairie land in the U.S. became known as the Dust Bowl. The period of time came to be called the Dirty Thirties. Farms, equipment, and homes were sometimes buried in the huge dust storms. At the same time, the U.S. was experiencing a major economic crisis, known as the Great Depression.
Mother Nature and the failed economy displaced millions of people who lived in the Dust Bowl. And so began the largest human migration in the United States. Route 66 played a major part in that westward movement of desperately poor people. Hundreds of thousands of people headed west. Many were poor farmers, but teachers, doctors, and other professionals also fled the Dust Bowl. entire towns disappeared. Whole communities hit the trail. For many, that trail was the newly commissioned Route 66. The highway crossed much of the Dust Bowl into the more fertile land of California. The migrants collected their families and the possessions they could keep. They loaded them into wagons and cars. The trek west continued through the 1930s until the beginning of World War II.
Dust Storm Disaster, by American folk legend Woody Guthrie, paints a picture of the Route 66 travelers.
It covered up our fences, it covered up our barns, it covered up our tractors in this wild and dusty storm. We loaded our jalopies and piled our families in. We rattled down that highway to never come back again.
Migrant camps sprung up along Route 66. Most were along narrow man-made waterways used to water crops. This provided the migrants with water for drinking, cooking, and bathing. These poor temporary villages were called ditchbank camps. The writer John Steinbeck traveled Route 66 and visited some of these camps in 1936 and 1937. He reported about them for a newspaper. Steinbeck's news stories were central to the creation of his most famous novel, The Grapes of Wrath. The novel made the road famous and gave it its most popular nickname, the Mother Road.
That book tells the story of the Jodes, a poor migrant family that travels Route 66 from Oklahoma to California during the Dust Bowl period. Steinbeck writes,
66 is the path of a people in flight, refugees from dust and shrinking land, from the thunder of tractors and shrinking ownership, from the desert's slow northward invasion, from the twisting winds that howl up out of Texas, from the floods that bring no richness to the land and steal what little richness is there. From all of these the people are in flight, and they come into 66 from the tributary side roads, from the wagon tracks and the rutted country roads. 66 is the mother road, the road of flight.
Today, it is mostly tourists who travel the full distance of Steinbeck's Mother Road. The Dust Bowl and the Depression have long passed. Route 66 is no longer a road of flight, but it remains a powerful symbol of America's westward migration that continues to this day. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver. Join us next week as we continue our journey down the Mother Road.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. Kurdish fighters, supported by American airstrikes, have recaptured the northern Iraqi town of Sinjar from Islamic State militants. Iraqi Kurdish President Masoud Barzani made the announcement Friday. The U.S.-backed coalition had not yet discussed the operation, but witnesses told the Associated Press that Kurdish forces, also known as Peshmerga fighters, were in control of the center of Sinjar. The battle to retake the town started on Thursday after more than 1 week of daily airstrikes by the U.S. The Islamic State group had captured the town of mostly ethnic Yazidis from Iraqi government forces last year. The group's attack on the Yazidi minority led to the first of more than 5,000 U.S. airstrikes against the Islamic State. On Thursday, Kurdish officials said the Peshmerga fighters controlled villages on either side of Sinjar and the important Highway 47 between Mosul in Iraq and Raqqa in Syria. The Islamic State group uses the highway to transport weapons, supplies, and illicit oil to fund its operations. Colonel Christopher Garver is a spokesman for the U.S. Combined Joint Task Force against the Islamic State. He said that the operation would disrupt funding for operations, stem the flow of its fighters into Iraq, and further isolate Mosul from Raqqa. About 7,500 fighters took part in the battle to retake Sinjar. A military advisor to the Kurdish Prime Minister's office said local residents have joined the fight. They want to establish a safe area to protect civilians. Jan Kubisch is the top UN official in Iraq. Earlier on Wednesday, he told the UN Security Council that Iraqi forces and Shiite militias have made some progress in the fight against the militant group. He said the pro-government forces have proven their ability to conduct military operations in several areas simultaneously. The UN envoy believed that morale of the fighting forces is high on the side of the government, and they are able now to register successes. He added that more operations are planned in Anbar province. He warned, however, that the militant group, also known as ISIL or ISIS, is far from defeated. ISIL continues to possess the funding and military capacities to prolong its reign of terror over large swaths of Iraq, he said. The Islamic State began its offensive in Iraq last year. The group seized at least one-third of the country. More than 3 million civilians were displaced. Thousands of Iraqis and Syrians are seeking safety by making the dangerous trip to Europe over land or by sea. The latest UN report on Iraq expressed concern about the militants' abuses of civilians. These include killings, kidnappings, rape, torture, forced recruitment of children, and looting. The group is also believed to hold captive about 1,500 women and children from the minority Yazidi community. The UN says more than 8.6 million people need urgent humanitarian assistance. And that's In the News. I'm Mario Ritter. Now, for VOA Learning English, the program American Stories. Today, we begin a new series from a book by American writer Edgar Rice Burroughs. The book is called A Princess of Mars. It is the first book in a series that Mr. Burroughs wrote about a man who travels to Mars during the last years of the 1800s. There, the man meets strange beings and sees strange sights. At first, he is a captive, then a warrior, and after many battles, a prince of a royal family. Shep O'Neill begins the story of A Princess of Mars.
I am a very old man. How old, I do not know. It is possible I am 100, maybe more. I cannot tell, because I have never aged as other men do. So far as I can remember, I have always been a man of about 30. I appear today as I did 40 years ago. Yet, I feel that I cannot go on living forever. Someday, I will die the real death from which there is no escape. I do not know why I should fear death, I, who have died 2 times, and am still alive. I have never told this story. I know the human mind will not believe what it cannot understand. I cannot explain what happened to me. I can only tell of the 10 years my dead body lay undiscovered in an Arizona cave. My name is John Carter. I am from the state of Virginia. At the close of the Civil War, I found myself without a home, without money, and without work. I decided the best plan was to search for gold in the great deserts of the American Southwest. I spent almost a year searching for gold with another former soldier, Captain James Powell, also of Virginia. We were extremely lucky. In the winter of 1865, we found rocks that held gold. Powell was trained as a mining engineer. He said we had uncovered over $1 million worth of gold in only 3 months. But the work was slow, with only 2 men and not much equipment. So we decided Powell should go to the nearest settlement to seek equipment and men to help us with the work. On March 3rd, 1866, Powell said goodbye. He rode his horse down the mountain toward the valley. I followed his progress for several hours. The morning Powell left was like all mornings in the deserts of the great Southwest, clear and beautiful. Not much later, I looked across the valley. I was surprised to see 3 riders in the same place where I had last seen my friend. After watching for some time, I decided the 3 riders must be hostile Indians. Powell, I knew, was well armed and an experienced soldier, but I knew he would need my aid. I found my weapons, placed a saddle on my horse, and started as fast as possible down the trail taken by Powell. I followed as quickly as I could until dark. About 9 o'clock, the moon became very bright. I had no difficulty following Powell's trail. I soon found the trail left by the three riders following Powell. I knew they were Indians. I was sure they wanted to capture Powell. Suddenly, I heard shots far ahead of me. I hurried ahead as fast as I could. Soon, I came to a small camp. Several hundred Apache Indians were in the center of the camp. I could see Powell on the ground. I did not even think about what to do. I just acted. I pulled out my guns and began shooting. The Apaches were surprised and fled. I forced my horse into the camp and toward Powell. I reached down and pulled him up on the horse by his belt. I urged the horse to greater speed. The Apaches, by now, realized that I was alone and quickly began to follow. We were soon in very rough country. The trail I chose began to rise sharply. It went up and up. I followed the trail for several hundred meters more until I came to the mouth of a large cave. It was almost morning now. I got off my horse and laid Powell on the ground. I tried to give him water, but it was no use. Powell was dead. I laid his body down and continued to the cave. I began to explore the cave. I was looking for a safe place to defend myself, or perhaps for a way out, but I became very sleepy. It was a pleasant feeling. My body became extremely heavy. I had trouble moving. Soon, I had to lay down against the side of the cave. For some reason, I could not move my arms or legs. I lay facing the opening of the cave. I could see part of the trail that had led me here. And now, I could see the Apaches. They had found me, but I could do nothing. Within a minute, one of them came into the cave. He looked at me, but he came no closer. His eyes grew wide. His mouth opened. He had a look of terror on his face. He looked behind me for a moment and then fled. Suddenly, I heard a low noise behind me. So could the rest of the Apaches. They all turned and fled. The sound became louder, but still I could not move. I could not turn my head to see what was behind me. All day I lay like this. I tried again to rise and again, but I still could not move. Then I heard a sharp sound. It was like a steel wire breaking. I quickly stood up. My back was against the cave wall. I looked down. There before me lay my body. For a few moments, I stood looking at my body. I could not bring myself to touch it. I was very frightened. The sounds of the cave and the sight of my body forced me away. I slowly backed to the opening of the cave. I turned to look at the Arizona night. I could see 1,000 stars. As I stood there, I turned my eyes to a large red star. I could not stop looking at it. It was Mars, the red planet, the red god of war. It seemed to pull me near. Then, for a moment, I closed my eyes. There was an instant of extreme cold and total darkness. Suddenly, I was in deep, dreamless, peaceful sleep. I opened my eyes upon a very strange land. I immediately knew then I was on Mars. Not once did I question this fact. My mind told me I was on Mars, as your mind tells you that you are upon Earth. You do not question the fact, nor did I. I found myself lying on a bed of yellow-colored grass that covered the land for kilometers. The time was near the middle of the day, and the sun was shining full upon me. It was warm. I decided to do a little exploring. Springing to my feet, I received my first Martian surprise. The effort to stand carried me into the Martian air to the height of about 1 meter. I landed softly upon the ground, however, without incident. I found that I must learn to walk all over again. My muscles were used to the gravity of Earth. Mars has less gravity. My attempts to walk resulted in jumps and hops, which took me into the air. I once landed on my face. I soon learned that it took much less effort for me to move on Mars than it did on Earth. Near me was a small, low wall. Carefully, I made my way to the wall and looked over. It was filled with eggs, some already broken open. Small, green creatures were in them. They looked at me with huge red eyes. As I watched the fierce-looking creatures, I failed to hear 20 full-grown Martians coming from behind me. They had come without warning. As I turned, I saw them. One was coming at me with a huge spear, with its sharp tip pointed at my heart.
I'm Mario Ritter. You have been listening to American Stories and our version of A Princess of Mars. The voice of John Carter was Shep O'Neill. Our program was written for radio, produced and directed by Paul Thompson. Join us again next week for the next part of Edgar Rice Burroughs' story, A Princess of Mars, on The Voice of America.